Welcome to In the Hive here on KCPW 88.3 FM. I'm Roger McDonough. Well, what a week it has been here in Utah. Yesterday's earthquake made us feel perhaps even more helpless than we were already feeling in the face of a global pandemic. But while the shaking has, at least at this exact moment, stopped, the spread of the coronavirus has not. In fact, just last night we learned that the latest high-profile Utahn to test positive for the disease was 4th District U.S. Representative Ben McAdams. We'll get to the overall numbers in just a bit. To try to curb the spread of COVID-19, a number of measures have been put into place. A state of emergency has been declared by various government jurisdictions. Schools have been closed. Social distancing recommendations instituted. Restaurants converted to takeout and delivery options only. Utah hospital systems are delaying elective surgeries and other non-emergency procedures to preserve resources for an expected influx in coronavirus patients. And there's a standing order from the president and Utah's governor to not congregate in groups larger than 10. So where did COVID-19 come from? How exactly does it spread? Do we know much about what the future holds for the virus? And what can we learn from our experiences with other infectious diseases? On the show today, we're doing a live Q&A on coronavirus, focusing especially on questions pertaining to the science behind the virus and on its implications for individual and public human health. Joining me by the phone are three guests who can speak to your medical and scientific questions on this topic. Dr. Lindsay Keegan is an epidemiologist at the University of Utah School of Medicine. And Dr. Keegan, thanks very much for being with us here on the show today.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Appreciate it. Keegan McCaffrey is an epidemiologist with the Utah Department of Health. Many thanks to you for being here as well, Keegan.
Thank you.
And Emily Spivak is an associate professor of medicine in the Division of Infectious Diseases with University of Utah Health. Dr. Spivak, thanks to you as well.
Thank you for having me.
And one aspect of our current reality is that instead of bringing various people into a small radio studio to have this conversation, we're doing this in a phone call, and our audio quality will suffer some as a result. We ask listeners for your patience on that front. We also invite you to participate. Do you have questions, again, from the science and health side about how the virus spreads, how long it lasts, where it's headed? Call 801-355-TALK or tweet using the hashtag UtahCOVID19. Again, 801-355-8255 or on Twitter using the hashtag UtahCOVID19. I want to begin today with a Utah-specific update on coronavirus. And Keegan McCaffrey with the Utah Department of Health, I was hoping that you could help us help tackle that for us if you have that information handy. I mentioned that Representative Ben McAdams says he tested positive. What are the current numbers when it comes to confirmed cases of the virus in the state of Utah?
Yes. So we update our numbers about noon every single day, and so this is our update from yesterday. But as of yesterday, we had 63 cases of COVID-19 in Utah. The majority of those, 53, were from Utah residents who tested positive here. But we've also seen a number of people that have traveled to other states or other countries that have tested positive. So there's 10 visitors that have traveled here, gotten sick while they were visiting Utah, and then tested positive. Most of our cases have been in Salt Lake County and Summit County, but we've also seen cases starting to happen across the state, to be expected as we see increasing transmission across the country.
And Keegan, I'll direct this question to you, but I might ask the other guests on the show here to weigh in as well. But should we assume community transmission of this virus is more widespread than those numbers that you just read to us represent?
Absolutely. So these are laboratory confirmed cases. We're continuing to build laboratory capacity, but we also know that a lot of people with COVID-19 have really mild illness. They might not even know to go to call their doctor and to get tested. And so we think this is definitely an underestimate. We know that some of these cases have been people that have not traveled outside of Utah. So especially in Summit County, Wasatch County, and Salt Lake, some of these cases have happened in people that have not traveled. And so it's safe to assume that it is here in Utah, maybe not the rate that it is in other states, but this is definitely an underestimate.
Dr. Lindsay Keegan or Dr. Spivak, do either of you want to weigh in there on just the community spread that we imagine or we suppose is happening, but we don't have confirmation from tests yet?
I would agree with Keegan 100%. You know, we have ramped up testing, and at the University of Utah, our positivity rate of our test is about 6%, so we are catching cases and think that that reflects that we're probably testing appropriate people, but we clearly are probably missing some patients. And there's, while we think the majority of transmission is from symptomatic patients, there is some evidence that asymptomatic patients can transmit the infection. So there are probably people that we aren't testing because they're not presenting to care and aren't clinically sick that may be transmitting the infection. Again, probably a minority of patients, but I would agree, you know, we have evidence of community spread, and we're probably just detecting the tip of the iceberg.
You know, I'll have each of you actually introduce yourselves as you speak, and was that Dr. Keegan who was speaking right there?
I apologize. That was Dr. Spivak.
Oh, excuse me. My apologies. How about Dr. Lindsay Keegan? You're an epidemiologist at the University of Utah School of Medicine, just on the idea of community spread.
Yeah, so I think at this point we're pretty sure that there's community spread, so I would agree with the other two experts on the call. One of the things, without having early testing ramped up, you know, we're just sort of getting into testing, ramping up the testing. So we probably missed a lot of early cases that had not had travel associated with it. And so in that case, when you miss the early testing, you allow spread to happen, you know, before people were social distancing. And so we'll be sort of catching up as we ramp up testing to catch people who have more mild symptoms, maybe don't need to present to the hospital because they aren't severe pneumonia. So we'll be starting to catch those as we ramp up testing, but we can rest assured that there's definitely community spread going on that's undetected.
Well, I want to talk about the importance of social distancing and a number of other topics on the show, but before we get to some of the frequently asked questions, how about, and this might be a question for Keegan McCaffrey, the numbers of people who have actually been tested. How many people is that, you know, here in Utah that we have seen actually tested?
Yeah, so as of yesterday, we have tested at least 1,200 people. That's an underestimate also because some of the large national labs aren't yet reporting their negative results to the Utah Department of Health. We're working on bringing those systems online, and we'll be updating those numbers as we get it. Testing is increasing. Just on the 17th, 2 days ago, we ran over 300 tests in Utah. But it's important to note that we are facing shortages in some testing availability for the reagents that we need to run the tests, for swabs. Unfortunately, here in the U.S., we're getting hit right as the entire rest of the world is getting hit by this virus, and that's limiting some of our capacity to test as broadly as we'd like to.
And I'm imagining that people who are coming back as negatives that, say, private groups are testing aren't being reported to your health department. Is that correct?
No, the vast majority are. We just have a couple of labs that we're still waiting to get those data.
Okay. I want to, we're going to return to some testing questions in just a bit, and we will shortly turn to questions that have been submitted to us. And again, you can tweet using the hashtag UtahCOVID19, and we will be watching closely for your questions. But there's something that I've been wondering, and I'll direct this to begin with, to infectious disease physician Emily Spivak to start. Is there any end in sight? You know, how long should we expect lockdowns and quarantines and social isolation, or can we know that, Dr. Spivak?
So I'll give my answer, and then I think this would also be a good question for Dr. Keegan, maybe. So the honest answer is I don't know.
Right.
I think we, again, we're seeing things starting to climb, and a lot of that represents the fact that we are ramping up testing, so we're able to detect more cases. So it is anticipated or expected that we are seeing the rise in cases that we are. But as long as we're on the upslope, I think it's hard to know when the peak is going to be, and as long as we're seeing a rise in cases, it's really hard to know. And I think not only the number of cases and illnesses, but also the longevity of this really depends on the public health recommendations and actions that we take, and how well people take the recommendations of public health officials, specifically, most importantly, social distancing, as we know and think that the predominant mechanism of spread is through respiratory droplets and relatively close contact with other people. So that's why social distancing is so important. And I think at this point, it is really hard to know when the end will be, and it depends on our actions.
Okay. Dr. Keegan, Dr. Lindsay Keegan, any thoughts on how long this new reality will last?
Yeah, so I have two answers to that. The first answer is we can look very closely at countries who have already seen coronavirus peak and then start to come down. So that would be China in Wuhan and then in South Korea. And in both of those, we start to see things peak and then start to calm down around 3 months. That's not to say that we're necessarily exactly on the same track as them. You know, both of them have done amazing public health interventions. But that's sort of the best we can do right now, since it's a novel virus and we have very little experience with it, is look to countries who have already experienced this. And so the second answer I'll give, I know you want to talk about the epidemic curve and flattening the curve later, but it really depends on that. So when everybody at this point, I think, has heard of flattening the curve, so the curve we're trying to flatten is the epidemic curve. So that's the number of new infections per day. And so if we just let coronavirus run rampant through the population, nobody changes any of their behavior, and it just spreads, you know, as it would, you're going to have the epidemic peak a lot sooner than if we do social distancing and if we do these public health interventions. And that's the entire point of the public health interventions, is that to not overrun our hospital systems, we need to slow down the course of this epidemic. We need to make sure that we don't have so many people showing up to the hospital needing ICU beds, needing ventilators at exactly the same time. So what functionally that does is it brings down the peak, but it draws out the length of the epidemic. So in some ways it can be frustrating, because by doing public health interventions, you make it last longer. But as a result of doing those public health interventions, you end up saving hundreds or thousands of lives. So it's sort of a non-answer, but...
No, it's a good answer. I mean, and let's dig in on social distancing, actually. And I do have some questions that people are submitting that I want to get to. But, I mean, the importance of social isolation as well, or of not social isolation, but of not going out, of not being in contact with people who, though they are asymptomatic, might be carriers of the disease and transmitting it, is to effectively save the healthcare system and thereby save lives. But at the same time, I guess a question that I have that may be unanswerable at this moment is how widespread over time, and we're trying to draw this out, how widespread over time should we expect it to become, and what is that time frame? Does anybody want to?
So the thing that I think we should all think about with social distancing is, if you think about, you have a campfire in a campfire ring. If you clear the leaves away from the campfire ring, when the sparks inevitably come out of the fire, there's nothing to catch fire and then catch the forest on fire. That's sort of the idea of social distancing. If we separate, you know, if we separate ourselves from these big groups, the virus doesn't have the ability to reach the number of people. If you're only interacting with a couple people a day, you can't potentially infect dozens of people. Right. You know, the initial case in New York, the person went to, I think it was a wedding or a funeral or something, and they interacted with hundreds of people, and as a result, they caused something like 30 or 40 secondary infections. And so if you don't interact with 30 or 40 people, you don't have the ability to do that. And so that's what we're trying to do with social distancing. And the thing that's the most important with social distancing is, because this is growing exponentially, the earlier you intervene, the earlier you stop interacting with other people or with large numbers of other people, the more effective, because it's going to grow exponentially. So if you stop one case early in the epidemic, that's going to prevent so many more secondary and tertiary cases than if you wait until we hit the peak and then try to intervene. So early on, when it seems like there's nothing happening, this is the best time to do social distancing, not when you get to the point of ICUs being overrun and, you know, hundreds of cases in the community.
Okay. It sounds like in terms of the length, how prolonged this will be, to some extent, that's obviously the point of what we're doing is to help the healthcare system. I want to turn now to some questions from people who have tweeted the hashtag #UtahCOVID19 or who have otherwise reached out to us. We had a call. Abel from Salt Lake City has a question. He didn't stay on the line, but he asks, if someone has been exposed and recovered from the virus, what happens if they are re-exposed? Is their immunity different? And I guess I'll just ask guests to weigh in as they see fit. And please introduce yourself as you answer that question. Anybody want to tackle that?
This is Dr. Sivak. I'll tackle it by saying we don't know. I would suspect that there would be some protective immunity or some less severe infection the second go-round if you were to get infected. But I think that we don't have the science yet to know if it's protective 100% or even 60% if you get infected for a sort of reinfection.
Okay. Anybody else want to weigh in?
Yeah, this is Dr. Keegan. I would also add that we need to keep in mind that this virus first emerged in humans in maybe November, December 2019, so we have such limited information on it. We can look to other coronaviruses to guess, but, that's anything that we say is going to be a guess at this point until we start to have more data.
Okay. On the topic of it entering the human population, where did this virus come from and how did it enter the human population?
So this is Dr. Keegan again. I guess the best understanding that we have is that this coronavirus was initially in bats, and then it entered a pangolin, not a penguin, but a pangolin,
right.
In China, and then somehow humans were interacting with the pangolins, I think either through eating them or through trading them. I'm not entirely sure exactly how, but...
A follow-up to... Oh, sorry, yeah. Does anyone...
This is Keegan McCaffrey.
Yeah.
So this is also what we've seen with other novel coronaviruses, where they move from bats to some sort of intermediate animal that people are dealing with or raising or selling, and then because of that close contact between those animals and people, it has the opportunity to jump. And then this virus took another unlucky jump where it became easily spreadable from person to person.
I want to get into how the disease is spreading. I mean, and the ways in which people can protect themselves. These are questions that have come in via Twitter as well over the past few days. I guess a question that somebody has is it airborne, if that question makes sense? Meaning, is it, do you have to be in close proximity to somebody to get it? We can also jump into contaminated surfaces on that as well. And again, I'm not certain who to direct that question to. Anybody want to jump in?
This is Dr. Spivak. I can jump in, maybe others can supplement. So we believe that the primary route of transmission is through respiratory droplets. And what that means is secretions that we sort of expel from our oral cavity and nose when we cough, when we sneeze, if we have sort of oral secretions. And those usually project out, we think, probably no further than 6 feet before they sort of fall to the ground. So that's why people are saying, stay at least 6 feet plus away from other people, specifically symptomatic individuals. There is some evidence that came out this week that there may be short-term aerosolization, and what that means is that the virus is in aerosols that can hang around in the air and travel further for a period of time. Now, and there's also evidence from that same study that the virus can persist on different materials. Different substances were tested, like cardboard and plastic and steel and copper, on some of those surfaces for hours or days. But the point I would make is that these were all studies that were done in a controlled scientific environment, not in a healthcare setting. And also, the study has not been done, or that doesn't tell us, well, if it can persist on a surface, can it then be picked up by somebody and transmitted to another person? We presume that that possibly can happen, and that's why we are giving messaging and advice for people to wash their hands regularly, to clean high-contact surfaces in the home and in the workplace frequently, because of the likelihood that the virus can persist on these surfaces. Again, how much that contributes to person-to-person transmission is not well known, or we don't know. The predominant mechanism is, again, through respiratory transmission, and that's why we're giving advice about sneezing in your elbow, again, staying away from each other. When people come into the healthcare setting, we're screening them at the front door, and if they have respiratory symptoms, diverting them and having them put a mask on, et cetera, so they're unlikely to expose other people, or less likely.
There's a follow-up that we've got here that's kind of probably the second half of the same question, which is how long does it live on things like, say, playground equipment? If you want to go play at the park with your kids, should you wipe all the swings down first? And that's just something we don't necessarily know. You said the primary mode of transmission is through close contact with people, but yeah.
Yeah, it's Dr. Sivak again. I think you could extrapolate from the study I was referring to and say, you know, most, I presume, playground materials are made of plastic and metal, and so, yes, in theory, it can persist on those surfaces. You have to remember that's outside. There's heat and cold and environmental other factors going on that may change the longevity that the virus lives on those surfaces. But from personal experience, I'll tell you, I'm taking my kids to the playground as long as there are not a lot of children and other people there. And we are washing our hands right after, either at the sink for 20 minutes or with hand sanitizer. So just to not alarm people, you know, it may be on those surfaces, but just use common practice that we're recommending. Avoid, you know, large crowds. If there's a lot of kids at the playground, I would avoid it and wash your hands judiciously, maybe throughout time while you're at the playground if you can, and, of course, when you're finished.
Okay.
And this is Dr. Keegan. I would just like to tag on to the end of that when we look at asymptomatic prevalence, so the people who have been infected but aren't showing any symptoms, we see that the highest rate of this is in children. So definitely avoiding the playground if there's large groups of children. They could be infected and potentially spreading the virus without showing any symptoms. So we should especially if you are in contact with somebody who's vulnerable, either through age or through immuno status, then definitely avoid large groups at the playground.
Okay. Yeah, Dr. Keegan McCaffrey, did you want to weigh in on that?
Yeah. So this also goes to some of our recommendations on isolating and quarantining yourselves. So isolation is asking people to stay home and stay away from other people when they're sick. And quarantining is asking people that have been exposed to somebody that's sick to stay home and not go out in public. And so people can protect people. They can protect themselves by staying away from crowds, doing good hand hygiene, avoid touching your face. But then if you're sick, it's really important, because this can be transmitted on surfaces, to stay home. If you have somebody that's sick in your home with COVID-19, also having the rest of your family and their close contacts stay home for 14 days. These are some of the things that we can do to help slow the spread. And while we're recommending social distancing and staying away from crowds, it's also important that people can still go to the park, be outside, enjoy time with their family. So
right.
It is definitely a balance.
There are a lot of questions to try to get through, and more are coming in, and we may not have time to answer all of them. We actually have about 4.5 minutes left, or 5 minutes left in the show. And so I'm going to just kind of march us along. A question that we had earlier was, can you get coronavirus twice? I don't think we know the answer to that, right?
This is Dr. Keegan, and that's correct. We don't know the answer yet.
Okay. How many hours from exposure does it take to get a positive test? So you've been in contact with somebody, you've been exposed to the coronavirus. If you go to the doctor straight away, will you test positive?
This is Dr. Spivak. Others jump in on this one. I think the answer is that we don't know exactly how long after you've been exposed until you turn positive. I'm not aware that that study has been done. What we do know is that patients who are symptomatic, who have what we think are typical symptoms, fever, cough, shortness of breath, we are finding the virus in them. We do not know the exact sensitivity and specificity, essentially how good the test is. But we do think that there are some people, again, if you're coming in early because you, quote unquote, think you might have been exposed, but you feel fine, that we see false, I won't say false negatives, we see negative tests in that setting. I don't know how many of those people subsequently will turn positive, but I think the message to people is don't go get a test just because you're worried, because as others have alluded to, we have issues with our test volume and supply chain, and while we're ramping up testing, we really are trying to focus it on those who have real symptoms and exposures and are most likely to have the infection, so that we can make sure we're not essentially wasting or using the test on people that are likely going to be negative.
And that seems like a message. And, go ahead, please. Yeah.
Oh, sorry. This is Dr. Keegan. I was just going to weigh in and say that there's about an average of 4 to 5 days before from exposure to symptom onset, and that ranges from 2 to about 14 days. So it could be faster or it could be slower.
Okay. Does the virus get weaker over time? I mean, as it makes its way through the population, or does it stay as, you know, virulent as it always is?
So this is Dr. Keegan. In general, we see that viruses mutate and become less virulent over time, and this is because if you think about the virus's, if you could say, goal, it's to spread as much as possible, and so if it kills off all of its hosts, it can't spread as efficiently.
Right.
So that's the short answer.
You know, we have a caller on the line who has a question that he wants to ask. And this is, I'm sorry, Dave in Salt Lake City. You've got a question for our panel.
Yeah, hi. I've been wondering about preventing the spread of coronavirus. And in particular, when you go to businesses and such, you find no hand sanitizer, like a table right at the front. There's some that are progressive in doing this, but I went to a car repair place the other day that had nothing like that. We have no masks. We have no tests. And what is Utah doing to work, say, with local distillers, chemical companies, manufacturers to make this at home in our home state here and find and get this out in the community?
Dave, let me direct that question to Keegan McCaffrey with the Utah Department of Health. Keegan, if you want to answer that.
Hi, good question, Dave. So, yeah, this is a problem that we're facing both nationally and internationally, shortages in these really key things that can help keep us safe. Soap, hand sanitizer, masks. I want to particularly mention that masks are only good for people who have COVID-19 and protecting those people around you. We do not recommend masks for healthy people. And we really want to help conserve masks for the healthcare setting. So we, as both a state and as a national government, are looking at ways that we can increase production of these things. We're looking at what we have stockpiled for healthcare settings. That's really what we're focused for. I think to the extent possible, the best way to protect yourself, again, is to stay out of crowds and practice social distancing, limiting the number of people you're around to 10 people, and then really washing your hands well with soap and water for 20 seconds. I know some businesses have had a hard time getting hand sanitizer, so if you are going out, when you get back, wash your hands really well with soap and water.
Dave, I'm going to...
This is
go
Dr.
Ahead.
Keegan here.
And I had a
follow-up
question.
Hang on. Dr. Keegan, go ahead.
I will add that washing your hands is actually more effective at killing coronavirus than hand sanitizer is. So if you go to businesses that don't have hand sanitizer, you can hopefully use their restroom and wash your hands thoroughly for 20 seconds.
Dave, in the interest of time, I'm going to have to let you go because we have other questions to try and get to. And I know you had a follow-up. I'm sorry about that.
On chloroquine, the efficacy of chloroquine and the tests that are out there on that. So,
any experts able to answer that question?
This is Dr. Sivek. I can answer that question. I'll tell In a nutshell, we don't know the clinical efficacy. There's some evidence, what we call in vitro or essentially in the lab, that chloroquine has some antiviral effect against coronaviruses, but studies are ongoing to really try and assess in a rigorous way the efficacy or how it may impact the clinical course in a patient.
Sorry about that. Thanks very much for that response. We're so close to the end of the show here, and I don't want to leave off without asking. Half an hour obviously was not enough time to get through the questions that we had today. But, for each of you who are involved in the world of healthcare right now, I wanted to ask a kind of broad question before we wrap up, which is, what is it like right now in that realm, working at a hospital, for example, Dr. Spivak?
Overwhelming, I would say. It's just there's a lot of moving parts, a lot of preparations, a lot of day-to-day monitoring of our supplies, our patient capacity, and there's a lot of information coming out. It's almost too much to process as you're also trying to take care of patients and monitor hospital infrastructure. But I'd say it's also exciting, and we are very lucky in this state to have a wide breadth of experts, public health officials, virologists, epidemiologists. So it's an exciting time, and I think we are well equipped in this state to handle it.
I'm so sorry about this, but we are wrapping up the end of the show. I guess I would ask Dr. Keegan to weigh in on that as well, if you'd like.
Yeah, I think overwhelming is a great way to describe it. I've been working into the wee hours of the night every night trying to get reports out to different public health officials who need them, trying to, debug models and come up with estimates and figure out new potential interventions that will be useful in terms of public health interventions. And it's just been absolute madness, but I think we are, as a scientific community, coming together and really producing some fantastic work on impossibly short deadlines to handle this. And the one thing I would say is, if you're out there and you want to help, really the best thing you can do is to practice social distancing, interact with as few people as possible, and just protect yourself and other people in the community who are at really high risk of mortality or other severe complications.
Thank you very much. I'm sorry to cut you off, and we must do a follow-up at some point. Lindsay Keegan, Keegan McCaffrey, and Emily Spivak, thank you so much for joining me on In the Hive today.
Thank you.
That does it for the show. You've been listening to In the Hive here on KCPW 88.3 FM. I'm Roger McDonough. Join us again next week. Both Sides of the Aisle is coming up next.